netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by SIGGRAPH Asia 2012, in Singapore from November 28th to December 1st. FX Guide is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source one-on-one with the masters of the craft. We do several audio and video podcasts. You can check out the full list over at fxguide.com/podcasts. This week, Mike Seymour talks with visual effects supervisor Adam Howard, which ties several things we've been covering on the site. Adam was a VFX supervisor on the latest Twilight film, and we have an FX Guide TV with the team at CBS Digital who are doing remastering work on Star Trek The Next Generation. We've also been doing more in-depth on that remastering work over at our online sister site, fxphd.com, where we offer training for visual effects artists. The term is in full swing. So many great courses going on with the best professors in the business and pricing you won't believe. Are you unhappy in your current job and looking to move on? Or maybe your project's ending and you have a break before your next gig. We've got the course you need to take your skills to the next level. So where to begin with Adam Howard? Let's start with awards. That list includes 4 Primetime Emmy Awards with an additional 5 nominations, 11 International Monitor Awards, and he's been honored twice by the AICP for Visual Effects and Animation. Adam's been at this for over 30 years. Projects he's worked on include Titanic, Pirates of the Caribbean 2, Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith, Master and Commander, War of the Worlds, Mission Impossible 3, Ghosts of the Abyss, Star Trek First Contact, Cliffhanger, Apollo 13, Star Trek Next Generation. Most recently, he supervised visual effects for Unknown, The Social Network, Season of the Witch, Twilight, Breaking Dawn 1 and 2, and Tower Heist. Recently on Facebook, Adam started updating some of his timeline with historical photos, and I got a kick out of looking at pictures go by as he posted pictures of himself with almost every legend you can think of: George Lucas, James Cameron, Steven Spielberg, J.J. Abrams, Robin Williams, Michael Douglas, Nicolas Cage, Jackie Chan, various Muppets on sets like Star Trek. Anyway, long list of projects and collaborations with Adam Howard, and let's jump now into that interview with Mike Seymour speaking with Adam Howard.
So, Adam, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Great. It's nice to be here.
So, you've got an Australian accent, but I wanted to start somewhere different than Australia. I wanted to start with how it was that you were nearly a Muppeteer and how you were a child star in Tokyo.
Child star in Tokyo. I was living in Japan, living in Tokyo because my dad was the marketing director for Squibb Pharmaceutical Company, and we were based out of Tokyo for 3 years. And there was a kids' TV show that was kind of like, I don't know, it's the closest Australian thing would be Humphrey Bear. There was this donkey character. And they would do a fairy tale each week. And they usually picked kids from the local schools to come in and play the characters. And so there was this one story about a beautiful little Japanese princess. She gets kidnapped by ninja warriors, and the brave young samurai come out and save her.
Now, did you get to play a ninja or a samurai warrior?
To play a samurai, yeah. Okay. So went down to NHK in the studio in Tokyo and had the full studio wardrobe and hair fitting. They made samurai wigs for us. I was 5 years old, and it was amazing. And had my first altercation with the director on that. Because I'm a 5 year old and I'm standing there, and these 8 adult stuntmen come out and they hand them all real swords. And then they come up to the two of us, and I was one of the kids, and the other samurai was a kid from Texas. And they handed us these little inflatable swords that were, they couldn't hit a flea. And I went up to the director, and I spoke fluent Japanese at the time, and I looked up at him and I said, "This isn't fair. Either we all have real swords or we all have plastic. I wanted a real sword." And he just went, "Shut up, kid. Just do the scene." And so we killed all these guys in 15 seconds. It was spectacular. And I didn't get my sword until many, many years later on Rush Hour 3 when I got one from that.
But, But it's got to have a bit of an influence of you being on set doing that at that age, surely, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember it so vividly because, you know, it's not a normal experience for a kid.
No.
And, to be there with the lights and the cameras and the directors and the stunt people and all that stuff. And I remember thinking at age five, yeah, this is what I'm going to do.
Okay, so now you don't become a Muppeteer. So you got to give me that story as well before we swing back to your wealth of visual effects experience.
Yeah, no, I met Jim Henson. He was in Melbourne promoting the Muppet movie. And I called the hotel. And, I, you know, in those days I used to try and track, you know, track down whoever was in town and say hello to them. And I had an autograph book that was great, and tons of people signed that. And I thought I'd try Jim. So I'd called the hotel, and they put me straight through to him, which was amazing. And we spoke for a while, and he was asking me what I was doing, and I was doing a graphic design course, and I had done a short film, and it had this character that was a kind of parody of God called Todd. And he said, well, what does Todd sound like? And I said, well, it's kind of difficult because he needs a reverb and all that. But he said, oh, just try me. And I said, look, I'll do you a deal. I'll do Todd if you do Kermit. And so, and we were talking on the phone. And so he said, okay. And so for like nearly 10 minutes, we just talked as these two characters. And he said to me, when we were finished, he said, you know, you're really good. You got a good voice. And if you ever come to New York, I'll give you a job on The Muppet Show. Or on Sesame Street.
Okay, Howard, you have to now give us Todd's voice. You can't tell that story and not give us the voice.
So long ago, I was.
Oh, come on!
I can't even really remember it, but it was something like this in the beginning. It had big looping kind of reverb. It was really fun.
So again, that's a completely pivotal figure in the history of modern culture, yet alone just the film industry.
Oh, absolutely. And I was so stunned that he said that. But in whatever kind of cynicism that existed in me at the time, I didn't really take it all that seriously. And so I never went to New York and never took him up on it. And then years later, when I was first living in the States, I was working on the Henson series Dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking with his son, Brian, who was directing the series. And on the first day I met Brian, and this story came up, and he went, oh, you idiot. He said, you should have done that, because he said that was Dad. He said, if he said that, he meant it. And he said, if you had shown up on his doorstep, you would have been on Sesame Street the next day. And then I met Carol Spinney, who's Big Bird, earlier on this year, and I told him the story. And he said, oh, absolutely. He said, you would have been there. So I missed out by that much.
But, you got to hang out with a couple of other good guys like Spielberg and Lucas and Cameron and people. So, you know, you probably, you know, that's a different path, admittedly.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're in Melbourne. You're older than the five-year-old and you've done this graphic design stuff. But your background at that time really was that of graphic design, not performing and not, you know, certainly visual effects as we know it today. Tell me how you got from that. I mean, it wasn't an odd path because, of course, television graphics was where computer graphics really entered the industry much earlier into television than it did into feature film. But what was your path?
Many, many years before, yeah. I mean, when I started, I was working at the ABC studios in Melbourne down in Elstonwick, and the only involvement that we had as a graphics department with computers was the weather graphics. And the weather graphics were done on this terrible old system that was just real garbage and very, very difficult and cumbersome to use. But, you know, we turned the weather graphics out every night and they worked. And at the time, it was kind of state-of-the-art stuff. But the graphics department at ABC was, I think there were about eight of us in the department, and everything was handmade. We, you know, if you were doing a news story and the news anchor had a picture of Reagan and Gorbachev for some international conference over their shoulder, it was literally going to Time magazine or People magazine and cutting out with a scalpel the heads and gluing them down and airbrushing shadows and rubbing down Letraset. And that was the graphic. And you stuck it in front of a video camera and they comped it in. And so I was about 17, and the art director at ABC, this guy Bruno Liepen, who was one of my first real mentors, called me into his office one day, and I'd been there about 3 months, and he said, so you need to come in and you need to sit down and I want you to close the door. And I thought, great, I'm going to get fired finally in my dream job and I'm going to lose it. And he looked at me and he said, no, you're not going to get fired. He said, so I need you to sit down because you're going to laugh really hard. And he said, see that huge box over in the corner? And this thing had arrived a couple of days before and none of us knew what it was. And he said, they say it's a computer that does graphics. And we just killed ourselves laughing. It's like, yeah, right. I mean, the systems we've seen so far have been garbage. And then he said, so look, you're the youngest one here. You've got the least program commitments of anybody. Just see what it's like. And when it's a piece of rubbish, just let me know and we'll get rid of it. And so I went and, you know, got engineering and we set up the box. And it was one of the first handful, literally handful, of Quantel classic paint boxes. And I think there were probably like 5 or 7 of them in the world at that point. And this was the 7th one. Say there were 7. There were 6 artists and 7 boxes. And so we plugged it in and it was phenomenal. And I went back to him the next morning and I said, you need to sit down this time. And I still don't really know where it came from, although the system was such a beautifully designed system. It was kind of fairly self-evident. But I said to Bruno, you have to buy this thing, and you got to do it now. And it was something ridiculous, like a couple of million bucks to buy this box. And he looked at me, and he said, you just think it's cool because it's some newfangled computer. And I said, well, probably. But the one thing I will tell you is that we have to buy this thing because this is the next major industrial revolution staring us in the face. And if you don't get on this bandwagon now, we're all going to be out of jobs in a few years. And so he went and he looked at it with me and went up to management and came down a few hours later and said, okay, well, it's done. And I said, what's done? And he said, we just bought it. And he said, you may as well run the department. So, because you're the only one that operated.
So your path in that respect wasn't actually that uncommon in the sense that the paint box was a terrifically enabling device to get into still sort of stuff. Obviously, this is a sort of a pre-Photoshop era of stuff being done like that. But then Quantel dovetailed into Harry, then Henry. And and along the way, it added, you know, various bits and pieces to have a bit of animation here and a bit of stuff there. And I should point out that the ABC worked with some outside design companies around this time that built their entire companies on Quantel boxes.
Absolutely. Graphic Paintbrush. And
Graphic Paintbrush was like the leading kind of design house in this country. But was that the thing that got you to the States, just having that sort of Quantel path? Because you didn't stay on Quantel for forever.
No. I was there for 4.5 years. And I, the one thing that I tried to do always with, you know, no matter what the technology was to always push stuff beyond what its original intent had been. And so with Paintbox, you know, Paintbox was, as you said, specifically designed to do still frames. And it was really designed as a graphic tool for news departments.
Yeah.
And so I said to them, well, look, it does still frames. It does full frame video still frames. What's animation? Animation is full frame images. Why don't we just start using this to do animated sequences for main titles? And so they all looked at me and said, you're out of your mind. And I said, well, let's just try it. And I ended up doing all these main titles on it. We got nominated for a Logie Award for the Jerry Connelly Show, which was heavily influenced by a combination of the main titles from Mission Impossible and Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer. you know, we did all this stuff that had, in many cases, never been done before. And it's funny, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and they said, so how does it feel to have done all these really kind of iconic things? And I said, look, at the time, that's not what it was. It was exactly the same as what we do now. You have a problem presented to you, and you have to come up with a solution. And, you know, we were just coming up with solutions. And fortunately, it was at a time when the whole business was changing dramatically. And the solutions that we came up with kind of became industry standards. But it was just, it was a very lucky time to be involved in it.
So you're in Sydney and you, sorry, Melbourne, and you're doing that kind of stuff, but you obviously, you know, obviously pretty soon are going to end up in LA. Was it a matter of going over there in hoping to break in, or did somebody sponsor you in? Because obviously even the visa thing is not a given.
No, I was working at AAV in South Melbourne, and, you know, the recession had been really bad there for a while, and commercial work was about all we could do. But it was, you know, Safeway Red Spot commercial steak this week is $2.95 a pound. And I'd been doing things like Around the Twist, and, you know, really fun shows that had great visual effects in them. And that stuff had just gone away. So I decided to come over and have a look. AAV was doing the dailies transfers for Mission Impossible that was produced by Paramount. And there was a producer in Melbourne from Paramount, and he said, you know, go over and talk to these guys, and you should go to the Post Group and try and meet Rich Thorne, see if you can get a job there, and I'll open some doors for you. So I came over in 89 and tried to see a lot of people. I met with Richard Edlund at Boss Films and a couple of people up at DreamWorks.
DreamQuest.
DreamQuest, thank you. Nothing really happened, although I kind of had the bug at that point. And I came back, and I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to make the move and hope for the best. And completely naively now, I set a goal of 3 months. And I thought, okay, well, if I can't get a job in 3 months, I'll get the message and I'll just go back home, not realizing that people spend decades here trying to get their dream job. And I came over with kind of the pipe dream of working on Star Trek The Next Generation and MacGyver, because they were the two kind of big shows on TV at the time. And it was, you know, a typical, not typical, but it was a very cool Hollywood moment. I was talking to this guy, Fred, at Paramount, who was the head of post-production. And I was talking to him on the phone, and we'd been talking for a couple of years. And he said, look, you know, I got to tell you, this probably isn't going to happen, because you're so far away and, you know, you're there and we're here and it's probably not going to happen. And I said, actually, I'm on Melrose. I can be there in 5 minutes. And he went, oh, well then come on down to Paramount. There'll be a drive on waiting for you. So I went to his office, walked into his office, and he finished the calls he was on, and he goes, okay, now who are you? And I told him, and what do you want? And I said, I'm trying to see Rich Thorne at the Post Group. And he said, okay, do you have a reel? And I said, yeah, I have. Would you like to see it? And he goes, nope, don't have time. And he picked up the phone, and he called Rich's assistant and said, so I have this guy here from Australia with the best reel I have ever seen in my life. He needs to see him tomorrow. So I did, and I couldn't. He hadn't even looked at the reel, but, you know, he and I had spoken for long enough that he kind of knew what I did. And I went and saw Rich, and Rich liked the reel, but couldn't give me a job. So I ended up working at ABC Television in Hollywood for about 7 months. And then out of the blue one day, the phone rang, and it was Rich Thorne calling. He said,
now, I'm just going to stop you there, because one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is I don't think this period in our kind of, I don't know, effects history has been given enough of a spotlight. So I just want to place some of these people for people. Because I was bumming around LA, coming back to a Sydney that time from being in London, and yeah. I visited a lot of those places. And so let's just set this up. The Post Group in LA was vast, cool, powerful, profitable, and just generally, like, Rich was not the owner there, right? Because his
He was the general manager. Fred Einstein was the owner,
right? And was it Linda Einstein, his daughter, that was also a manager?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And now, but Rich was the guy. Like, in terms of digital, kind of connected, wired, getting it. I'm not a personal friend of Rich, but I just remember him as being the guy in LA.
Yeah, I mean the Post Group was the most powerful post production company in the world.
Yeah.
At the time, and they were doing amazing shows.
And now, one of the reasons you didn't get in at Boss, right, is that they really weren't digital at the stage.
Yeah, correct. In fact, I spoke with Richard Edlund, and he said, you know, we're thinking of starting a digital division, and I think if you come back, and this was actually really the reason why I moved here, because he said, if you come back, I'll give you a job there. And then I got back to Australia and I talked to his general manager, and that guy said, that's never going to happen. Digital is just a flash in the pan. It's always going to be film. So there's not going to be a job when you come back.
I met Rich once, and I remember that it's a discussion around the D1 machines and digital video. And,
yeah.
And the discussion was, somebody had said, as a serious question, digital video, do you think it'll catch on? And I remember joking with Rich that, and I said, I'm not a close friend of his or anything, but I remember joking, well, I just couldn't conceive of a universe where someone would not think that digital video was going to happen. There wasn't even an on the radar whether it was or it wasn't. And yet there were people, as you say, that were just seriously thinking, yeah, I don't know if digital catch on, because 1-inch is so convenient and the cassettes are so bulky.
There were people who thought that the T-Model Ford was never going to beat horses.
So you've landed in the middle of, now, as I say, because the feature film industry, and no disrespect to them, but like places like ILM and now juggernauts of digital just weren't there. It was all happening in LA.
Photochemical film optical houses.
Yeah. So, and Star Trek The Next Generation also was pivotal in that, you know, it had some miniatures from ILM, but it really was a show that was grabbing hold of this kind of Harry Henry technology and running with it in a way no one thought was possible.
The interesting thing about Star Trek Next Generation was that even though the credits say visual effects by Industrial Light and Magic, the only shots that ILM ever did for the show are in the main title. It then says Digital Opticals by, it was originally the Post Group, and then it was Digital Magic. And all the visual effects work was done by either the Post Group or Digital Magic in that order. Nothing was done by ILM for the series.
And it's interesting because obviously a lot of that stuff's been digitally remastered at the moment. But this was an age where it was D1, right? This was like, you know, it was done at digital 4x3, but it was still standard def.
It was all D1. And it's funny, I remember a few years ago, I was back in Australia and I was going to speak at a Star Trek convention. And I went to Peter Lauritsen, who was the producer of the show, and said, look, do you mind if I cut a reel together to show this thing? And he said, no, it's fine. He said, you know the rules, just, you know, be good to us. And so I went back and I did all of my work on Harry, also Quantel Box, and I thought, I'm just going to go back and get all the tapes out and I'll just skim through them quickly and see what I can get. I had 46 one-hour D1s, 46 hours of elements and shots, literally just thousands of shots that we had done for the show over the years. And you know, kind of pouring through that to cut down a 9-minute reel took me about a week. It was crazy.
So let's just keep going with that thing in LA. So the Postscript was the powerhouse. I think Rich set up a digital unit, like an additional kind of annex wing, whatever, at Postscript, but it kind of went over budget or whatever. Anyway, he split, and now we have this whole new super hot house appearing on the scene, which is Digital Magic, right, over in Santa Monica.
Correct. Yeah, and that's when he called me. I was at ABC, and he said, are you ready? I said, for what? And he goes, well, we're doing it. I said, doing what? And he said, I'm starting Digital Magic. So I've left the Post Group. I'm taking a bunch of people with me, and I want you to come and join me. And the lead Harry guy at the time was a brilliant and fabulous guy who was a dear friend of mine, Steve Price. And he had done the first 4 seasons of Star Trek Next Generation. And Rich hired me to be Steve's assistant. And so, you know, here's me being in the country for 7 months with a dream of working on Star Trek. 7 months after arriving, I was working on Star Trek. It was just a complete mind warp. And so I'd been there for only a few weeks. And Steve came in and announced that he was leaving at the end of the week to go to ILM because Spielberg had asked him to go up and do the fairy dust for Tinkerbell in Hook. And so I thought, great. So I finally got the job I always wanted, and now I'm probably going to lose it. So that was a very stressful weekend because it was right at the end of season 4. We had just done the cliffhanger episode, and I really didn't do any work on it. I sat with Steve while he was doing the work. And I came in on the Monday, and Rich came in, and it's another, you know, walk-in, close-the-door moment. And he said, okay, I've got very, very good news and very, very bad news. And I said, oh, fantastic. So what's the very, very bad news? So the bad news is Paramount's really upset. They don't want Steve to leave. And they've been talking to him all weekend, but he's going. So, you know, we've just been dealing with that. I said, oh, that's shocking. So what's the good news? And he goes, well, the good news is you're it. And so I got in the seat and I took over from Steve immediately and you know, just became the lead animator on the show. And so the guys at Paramount were fantastic. You know, Dan Curry and Ron Moore and
Robert. Dan Curry's a great guy, isn't he?
Dan's a fantastic guy. I love him. He's a very dear friend. And, you know, all of those guys, it's a very definitely a family. We're all still very close. Ron Moore and I have done a couple of shows together over the years.
So Ron Moore, of course, at this point is an executive producer or producer on Star Trek, though, of course, we'll know him probably more from his work on...
That's Ron Moore, the writer. This is Ron Moore, the visual effects
producer. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But Ron Moore, the writer, was on Star Trek at this time, wasn't he? Because he would go on to do Battlestar Galactica, or am I...
And I said to the guys, look, you know, I love the stuff that Steve did, but I have a fundamental problem. We were specifically talking about phaser. And I said, I have a fundamental problem with the way they look. And they said, well, what's that? And I said, look, they're a light source. And Steve was hand-painting everything at that point. And I said, I think I can do it and make it look better. I just want to introduce interactive light and shadows to these things so that when a light source goes off right in front of somebody's face, it's going to light up their face and it's going to cast a shadow behind them. And they said, Dan said to me, well, look, if you can do it in the same amount of time that it took him to do the shots, have at it. And so I worked out a way of kind of streamlining the building of them a little bit and then introduced all this interactive light, which was all hand-painted interactive light on their faces. And, you know, something that Harry was really good at. And so we changed the look of everything. And then that first year, it was astounding. I'd always just wanted to go and stand outside the Emmy Awards and watch the red carpet happen. And two of our episodes got nominated, and I was on both of them. So we went to the Emmys, which was astounding. And then they announced the winners, and they said it's a tie this year. And we all looked at each other and thought, oh, okay, great. Well, we're not going to get anything. And they said the first winner is Star Trek The Next Generation. And so we went up and got an Emmy. It was astounding. And I was walking off the stage, and Marlee Matlin was announcing the awards, and she said, and the second winner is Star Trek The Next Generation. And I stopped halfway down the staircase, and the floor manager grabbed me, and he said, no, you've got to come this way. And I said, well, we won this one too. And he goes, oh, go back. So I walked back on stage with one Emmy in one hand, and she hands me the other one in the other one. And there's a photo of me somewhere, like leaning down to the mic, just going, get up here now, guys, for the second crew who were all on their way up from the auditorium. So anyway, yeah, Star Trek was extremely good to me over the years, and I was on it for 8 seasons.
And in fact, you'd go on to win 4 Emmys in total, right?
Yeah, nominated 9 times and won 4 for Star Trek Generation and for Star Trek Voyager, for the pilot caretaker, but nominated for every one of the series, Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise.
And really, yeah, and the significance of the show was enormous in terms of production workflow because there's two things going on here. We mentioned, you know, the advent of digital, but also you guys are turning around stuff in an amount of time that in the effects industry was just unheard of.
Oh, yeah, we had... For a long time, I was the only animator on the show. So I was doing – there were two crews. One crew would be shooting 1 week and the other crew would be posting. And then they'd flop and do the opposite. But meanwhile, I was sitting there every week doing the show. And so we had online editors, I mean, Pat Clancy and Scott Rader and Don Greenberg and just phenomenal people in the business. I mean, that show was just full of just the most incredible powerhouse group of people. It was a real, you know, pleasure to be part of. And we would, in my room alone, I know sometimes we would turn out like 60 shots a week. And this was the show that was the benchmark on worldwide television for visual effects.
Yep.
and they had to be perfect, but you had no time. I remember one time in Deep Space Nine, the little runabout ship, the Defiant, first showed up in the show, and they handed me the script pages, and it says, "The Defiant fires tri-cobalt devices." And I looked at Gary Hutzel, and I said, "Well, what the hell is a tri-cobalt device?" And he goes, "I don't know, just make it up." And he said, "But I'll be back in 20 minutes." And so I'm sitting there thinking, okay, try three cobalt blue, three spinning balls, trails. Okay, three spinning balls with a trail coming off them, firing out like machine gun pellets. Hand-painted that stuff, and it became lore. And, you know, for years afterward, that was what a tri-cobalt device was when it came up in the script. But, you know, we had to hit the ground running every time and just come up with stuff. We were lucky that we had this incredible list of reels, of D1 reels, that Dan Curry and Ron Moore had put together. They're called the DRE reels, the Dan and Ron elements. And they had so much stuff that they had shot practically, like smoke effects and laser effects through plexiglass and you name it, they had it. And we used that as our kind of Bible for visual effects elements because everything that we used was a photographic element that we then manipulated digitally.
So you're at Digital Magic, and is it Next Stop ILM, or how did you get between the two?
The next thing at Digital Magic was, before I moved, was we got the Quantel film system in, and we started a small film unit there, and we did The River Wild and Cliffhanger and a few other films there, which were really fun to work on. But then I moved to Pacific Ocean Post.
So just on Cliffhanger, I think Cliffhanger was one of the very first uses of tracking, like on the side of the mountain with the...
We did those shots. We did those shots, and then a lot of the close-ups on Stallone's arm where he had safety cables cutting into his arm and we had to rebuild his arm. And I actually did all of that stuff on Harry at standard def. At NTSC resolution, and then we bumped it up to 2K.
Wow.
And it's funny, I watched it again recently on an HD monitor, and it looks really good. but yeah, there was a lot of problem solving, and yes, the tracking was brand new and very, very primitive and glitchy, and you know, we got away with murder on that.
Digital Magic also had a Flame, right? I mean, Flame, we haven't mentioned it, but that came in at that time too, didn't it?
Very first Flame demo in the United States. And, you know, that was when Gary Tregaskis was still, you know, the Flame guy. And Gary came in and did the demo for us. And there were a few issues with it at the time that didn't really lend itself to us using it. But we said, look, you know, if you can incorporate these changes, we would consider getting one. And they did buy one, but it was after I left.
Right.
Because it was about 2 years later that all the changes really came out that made Flame what it was. And by that time, I was over at POP, and I was still working on Harry, but then the film unit opened up, and I was instrumental in helping start that up, and we got a bunch of Flames in there. And basically, Scott Rader and I were the two main guys on Flame.
Is this at Pacific Ocean Post, or?
Yeah. So that we were doing... TV was all on Harry, although we were doing Lisa Tomei was doing X-Files in the other room on a Henry. I did a couple of episodes of X-Files on Harry. But we had the Flames predominantly down in the film unit, and that was my move to Flame. And I was there at POP for about 4 years, and then left POP to do Armageddon. Pat McClung, who supervised Armageddon, asked me to go out and be the compositing supervisor for the film. So I went and did that and then just freelanced for a long time and had my own company for a couple of years and then went up to ILM after that.
Right. So you did Out of Time where? Or you were at Sony or something around that time at Seabiscuit?
At Complete Post in Hollywood.
Okay.
And it was just the main title and a few cleanup shots in it, but that was a fun show. You know, going back to P, the the biggest one for me at POP was Titanic. And you know, the story you guys did on Titanic a few months back was a great story because it really covered all the bases. But that was an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, it was. I think also a point that's sort of again forgotten is that when Titanic was not out yet, it was being railed on as being going to be a mega flop. For a start, we knew that there'd be no sequel, and we knew how it ended, and it seemed like a downer of a film. It was way over budget, and it just looked like it was never going to be finished. And it was not, before it came out, being well spoken of, was it?
No, I mean, you're right. People were really railing on it. And the funny thing from an insider's point of view was that the railing was coming from people who had not seen anything. They just thought, there is no way that this can possibly be a hit. And from our point of view on the inside, having seen what the stuff looked like, we knew that this was something very special. We had no idea that it was going to be as much of a blockbuster as it was. But I remember talking to my crew, because I was the visual effects supervisor at POP for it, and I just said to them, you know, this is going to be a very, very special film, and we're just going to pull out all the stops and make it perfect. And so we did, and I'm glad we did, because history proved the naysayers wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. So was Master and Commander your first film at ILM?
Yeah, it was.
So that was split between you and Asylum, wasn't it?
Yeah, Asylum was originally the lead house. And I think they were the lead house right up to the end of the film. But it was a very big, very complex show. And they got to the point where they needed to split it up. And the only house that really had the bandwidth to be able to handle the complexity of work was ILM. So they got that. And there was some problematic stuff that they'd been working on and couldn't come up with a solution for. And so my friend Papa Hellman, who I had worked with at Digital Magic, was up there, and he was working on it with Stefan Fangmeier. And he had them call me because they couldn't solve it. And he said, look, bring in the big gun, which I always like. So I went up there and I solved it in the first night.
What was that? You got to tell me what that is, because Pablo himself is great. What was this problem?
Yeah, it was a scene that had been shot in midday in Mexico on the deck of the ship, so everything was really hot, specular reflections and very bright and blown out. And Peter Weir decided that he wanted to make it 5 o'clock in the morning in deep fog, and so they were trying to work out different ways of adjusting the shots to make them work. And I ended up just doing it as a color correction. But one of the things that I've kind of done over the years is using a color corrector as a compositing tool. And they had not done that at that point. And so they kind of looked at me like I had three heads.
Can you elaborate a bit more on that? Because that, I mean, may not be immediately obvious. Certainly it isn't obvious to me how you would do that. I can imagine you could grade a shot to bring up the blacks and make it look misty, but how do you use it as a compositor?
In some cases, I would take the color corrector and just really whack color out completely. I mean, people tend to use color correctors fairly judiciously. And I tend to hammer shots with a color corrector because there's so much stuff that you can get out of an original element by really mega boosting saturation or contrast or whatever, and then extracting those elements as keyable elements to be able to put it all back together again and adjust it in ways that, you know, this is all pre-DI. And I think probably what I was doing at the time was more like what you're capable of doing in DI now, where you're treating it, the color correcting environment, as a compositing environment, because you can bring in power windows and garbage mats and all that stuff. But at the time, you couldn't do that. So I just used the color corrector as a tool beyond just tweaking color here a little bit and here. You know, it needed to be a really powerful thing that was more capable of extracting data than just the standard compositing system was. And so when you use them in conjunction with each other, you could really get some powerful stuff that, you know, no one really thought of doing before.
If someone's looking at your credit in IMDb or remembers this time when press is going out, you'd have been listed as a Sabre artist. Do you want to tell me what that was?
Yeah, Saber. I remember getting there and being so excited to work on Saber, and as all the other people in the Saber department had been when they first got there. And we got there, and it was Inferno. It was Inferno. The only thing that was different was that it had some extremely beautiful I/O functionality that Nori Kanazawa had written, and there were a lot of sparks and things that were ILM specific, but fundamentally the Saber department was an Inferno department.
So you'd be there at ILM for a while, covering just some incredible films: War of the Worlds, Star Wars, Mission Impossible. What from that period really stands out as something that you enjoyed working on?
Pirates of the Caribbean was really, Dead Man's Chest was really fun, just because it was such a silly film. A lot of the shots that I did were very, very silly shots, but they were fun because they were good problem solving things. I loved working on War of the Worlds because it was working with Steven and Alex Tropiak, and I stayed one very long weekend before ILM officially had the job. And Steven had a trailer that he wanted to release, and he was not happy with the shots that he had from another house. And so we agreed to stay all weekend and redo them all. And based on his feelings of the final result of that, they very happily said, yes, you get the whole film. So ILM were happy about that. But I think that the show that I really enjoyed the most at ILM was Jarhead.
Okay, now I was so glad you said that, because I really want to pick a bone with you over this. I'm not actually pick a bone, that's wrong. I want to ask you about it, because I was recently at a SIGGRAPH talk where Roger Deakins was talking about Jarhead and Pablo's role on it in particular. And it was a pivotal moment for Roger Deakins in his approach to visual effects. I don't know if you heard this SIGGRAPH talk, but he basically said that it was Pablo on Jarhead that said, you know, we need a lot of green screen, blah, 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 here, to cut a long story short. And Roger was like, well, it's going to be really hard to do. And then Pablo just looked at him and went, all right, don't worry about it. And he went, don't worry about it now or for the rest of my career. And Roger cites that as the point where he just realized that visual effects could follow, not lead, in getting a shot. Talk to me about Jarhead.
Jarhead was really fun because they had all the stuff that was shot in desert with, you know, whitish sand and blue skies. And we had to change it to be, you know, Iraq. And the main thing that we did was build the entire canopy of cloud that went over the desert and all the oil field fires that were burning in the sky. And so we built that in Inferno. And one of the guys there and I just spent a long time just building this huge, like, moving digital matte painting that was the entire environment, and we could track that into any of the shots. And we just basically had to work out, you know, along with Pablo and Sam Mendez, what the geography needed to be. And then once we knew where the oil fields were all kind of based, we just built this huge matte painting, and it was a big living behemoth of a matte painting that we would drag around in as low a res as we possibly could without compromising anything. And then, you know, the final renders were pretty long. I don't remember what they actually were, but they were pretty long because the amount of data that was involved in that thing was just massive. But, you know, my proudest moment of Jarhead was that when the For Your Consideration ads came out, Variety magazine took one of my shots and made it the entire front cover of Variety magazine, which was nice. And then the big hero shot that I did, which was it's guys in a pit in the background of the shot, and you see the horizon, and there's a soldier standing in the foreground holding a gun across his chest, and a god rays of sun coming down through the sky, which was, you know, an idea I had thrown at Sam. That ended up being like the DVD cover as well, which was cool. But it was nice because most people look at that show and they don't think visual effects at all. And, you know, this gets back to something that I need to say, because it happened to me very early in my career in the States. But I, when I was here in 92, I think, I met Linwood Dunn, who had, you know, in like 1916 or something, invented the Acme Dunn optical printer. So basically he created our jobs. And I said to him one, he called me at Digital Magic one night and we were talking, and I said, "So Lin, if I'm ever going to ask anybody this question, it's got to be you." I said, "What's the one guiding principle that you would recommend to me for a long career in visual effects?" And he went, "Oh, that's easy." He said, "You spend your whole career doing shots that no one notices." I went, "Okay." And he goes, "Because the second you do a shot and somebody says, 'Wow, what a cool visual effect,' you failed. You only have one purpose in this job, and it's to serve the story." And I thought, okay, that works for me. And so, you know, when Jarhead came out, no one said, "Wow, look at the visual effects. Wow, look at the horse that's the emaciated horse walking around in the desert." There was actually a full-blown, very healthy horse that ILM wizened down to the emaciated thing that it is in the film. You know, it was using visual effects for exactly what they're supposed to be, which is to really serve the story.
Which is exactly what Deacon's point was, I think. For him, that was a turning point, you know, in just working with shots with visual effects teams, that you guys were all servicing the story. And that moment when Pablo said, "Don't worry about it," was, you know, him not giving up, but saying what's important is what's on the screen, and you shoot it the way you need to shoot it.
Absolutely. And then I think that's something that used not to be the case worldwide. If you go back to simple things like, "Oh, it's a visual effects shot, it has to be locked off." The second that we were able to track cameras, a lot of the stigma of visual effects not serving story kind of went away. And it allowed filmmakers to get back to being storytellers that were not being pinned down by limitations of technology. And you know, it's a nice place to be in when a director says to you, "Are we screwed for not doing it this way?" And you just go, "No, it's fine. You know, we can fix it."
And you obviously have worked with a lot of directors and as a supervisor directly. Lessons that you've learned from them about that storytelling process, is there anything that sort of stands out in the same way? It's a bit of a broad question, I'm sorry.
No. Pay attention. I mean, there's a reason why they're the director. In many cases. In some cases there's not, but in many cases there are. I love working with really good directors who are just master storytellers. I love seeing how every director handles a film completely differently. You know, seeing how Jim handled Titanic, seeing how Steven handles War of the Worlds or anything else. I can't wait to see Lincoln. Apparently it's amazing, and I think he's probably born to make that film.
I actually thought War of the Worlds was a really good film, and the visual effects in it particularly so. I don't know that it got, I mean, it got quite a lot of attention, but it was a really really brave film for some of the shots done in that film.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of the stuff that you know, Pablo was on that again with Dennis Muren, and some of the stuff, like the big shot of Tom running toward camera with the bridge exploding behind him, just mind-blowing stuff, and the church ripping in half. You know, it's funny.
A combination of miniatures and digital and tracking and extensions. And
absolutely. I think the thing for me that is important, and it doesn't necessarily always come from the director to us. It's usually a two-way street of the conversation, is that just because you can do something digitally doesn't mean you should. There are still so many old ways to handle things that are, in many cases, much more fiscally responsible. And, you know, I think back to something like Unknown that I did in Germany a couple of years ago with Liam Neeson. And we had this huge car chase sequence, and there was a thought at one point that we were going to do a lot of the insert shots of them in the car as green screen shots. And I just said, "Look, you know, I don't think that's a good idea." I said, "We've got these incredible James Bond driving team stunt crew here, and we've got these, you know, Russian arms and British sticks and, you know, everything that you could possibly want in camera rigs. And I said, let's just be clever about it and shoot it all in camera. I said, because really my job is not to build as many visual effects shots as I possibly can. It's to help you choose the right way of doing it to tell the story the best way possible. And, you know, and so in the end, we ended up doing probably 98% of that sequence in camera, with very minimal little bits of, you know, rig removal occasionally, but most of it's just in the can as we shot it.
Tell me, was Rush Hour 3, were you still at ILM or had you left? Because ILM worked on Rush Hour 3, didn't they?
I was at ILM. I just finished doing Nightmare Before Christmas 3D release, and John Bruno called me and he said, I want you to come and be my co-soup on the show. And because it was a massive show. So we went and, did that show. It was phenomenal. So I left ILM, went to Paris for a month and shot there. We were shooting in the Eiffel Tower and, you know, just doing crazy stuff. And working with Jackie Chan was amazing. But then I came back and I was able to come back to ILM as a client, which was really nice. And they did a really beautiful job. Linda DiQuattro was the in-house soup, and it was the first time they had a female supervisor on a show at ILM, so that was a big deal. And she did an awesome job, and it was a massive film. I think we had 17 post houses working on it, all in the States, I think. Yeah, maybe no, there might have been a couple in Canada, but it was a fun show.
And also, I guess, sort of somewhat unusual because of the physical nature of one of your two leads, that you're doing stuff. I mean, there are not many actors in the world that do what Jackie Chan does in front of a camera to incorporate into effects sequences.
Yeah, and the good thing about working with Jackie was that he, you know, we would shoot all day and then we'd go to editorial at night and he would come to editorial with us. And I learned so much about cutting action sequences from him. Anyway, he was there, and then our second unit director and stunt coordinator, Connie Palmisano, the combination of those two guys as a learning tool was just astounding. But yeah, Jackie would do things that, you know, no one else would do. And the thing about Jackie is that he will never do anything that he wouldn't do himself. He would never ask anybody to do something that he wouldn't do himself. And I really admired that about him. He's a really good man, and he was always one of my heroes anyway, but he definitely is now.
I take nothing away from him, but also he was, or he is now, about 58 or something, right? He must have been at least in his... something like that.
Yeah, something. He's about 57, 58, something like that, yeah.
So, again, he's doing a lot of this stuff. In 2007, I think you were doing Rush Hour 3.
Correct.
But he's still got to be in his 50s, right, or about. I mean, that's quite demanding.
Okay, well, you can work it out. He turned 52 while we were doing that show.
Okay.
And, yeah, I mean, look, we were on the Eiffel Tower one night, and at 75 miles an hour, they shut the tower down, even to the employees. You have to get off the thing. And at 72 miles an hour, he was still doing the stunt on a single pick point cable, swinging from one leg to the other, like 450 foot free fall swing, 600 feet in the air. Just incredible stuff. And I've got some video that I shot of him somewhere, where he's holding onto one of the girders wrapped in blue plastic and the rain is just pummeling down on him. And we were all saying, Jackie, come on down and just stop. And he goes, no, we're not finished yet. It's not right. We need to do one more take. So just wait until the rain stops. And he's just sitting there. He's getting destroyed by the rain. The rain stopped and we did one more take and he was happy and he came down.
So you're obviously now a production supervisor in the sense that you're not attached to a facility in the way that a facility supervisor is.
Yeah, and great. It's
in that capacity that you joined to help out on the... I mean, you've obviously done some other films in between, but I'm just going to jump to the later stuff, which has just hit the box office and looks like it's going to go tremendously well over the Thanksgiving weekend, which is Twilight. And I'm going to say that this last sort of film seems to have got, especially the wolves, better than they've ever been looking before. Was it fun filming?
Yeah. I know that you've been talking with Phil on the guys, but the stuff that Tippett did, I saw it for the first time the other night, and the wolves are absolutely brilliant. I think with different directors on all the films, except for the last two, with Bill Condon doing both of the final films, there was a tendency to kind of have directors wanting to inject their own thoughts into the wolves, and they didn't always necessarily stand up all that well. But the wolves in this one are absolutely beautiful.
They're really nice, aren't they?
There's one incredible shot where one of the wolves gets thrown against a tree, and it hobbles back up to its feet, and another wolf goes over and just kind of nuzzles into it. And it's just the most beautiful bit of animation. And I've still got a right to Phil because I haven't had a chance to yet, but it was really beautiful stuff. And you know, it's always such a pleasure to be on set with somebody like Phil Tippett. You know, he inspired so many of us with his stuff in Star Wars. And then, you know, you're standing on set with him and he's like, "Hey, Ed, how you doing?" It's like, "Oh, Jesus, it's Phil Tippett. Wow." But he's just a really nice guy and a very genuine guy, and he's just an uber genius. And his crew are fantastic too. I mean, he's got a great people who work with him, and they were a pleasure to watch.
The trouble with talking to someone with you, someone like you with such a really great career spanning so many films, is that we don't get specific enough, I think, on individual bits. So let's be specific on this film at least, and I'll make up for earlier mistakes and say, let's discuss some of that end fight sequence with the wolves. And talk to me about, because on set you don't obviously have any wolves, how are you framing up those shots, and how is the production dealing with this environment, especially as one of the actresses is very young?
Well, the main issue with that sequence was that, you know, obviously we were not shooting it in the snow. We had to have a controlled environment. So we were shooting it in a big kind of agricultural cow palace in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And, you know, it would be stinking hot out there and stinking hot in the stage, and it's paper snow on the floor and surrounded by green screen. So basically all you see for months on end are white and green, which, you know, has an effect on you after a while. And we had some, you know, had to be very careful of health issues because the paper snow kind of turns into microfiber and blows around a bit. And so, you know, especially with little Mackenzie Foy, who was playing the young child, she, you know, we had to make sure that she had, like, breathing masks and all that stuff so that she was okay. But we were all very careful about it. And it was just an incredible second unit on that show, whose handling of the stunt work was really magnificent. It's a very long sequence in the film, and it works. It works. I mean, there's some really fun stuff, beautiful prosthetic makeup work, a lot of, like, digital beheadings, and then just an extraordinary amount of set extension, which, you know, you can use the green screen to an extent, but at some point you've still got to do some pretty heavy-duty blending on the ground and a lot of roto. And a lot of that stuff was handled by various companies up in Canada and I think Hydraulics down here and a couple of other companies. But, yeah, beautiful work. And the wolves were all styrofoam – not styrofoam. They were like foam core, heavy foam core cutouts. The
guy. Yeah, so – they looked a bit like a giant toy, right? In the sense that they're not just a flat cutout. They've got depth to them.
They were flat for the center line of their body, let's say down their spine. It was one big cutout. But then in some cases they would have a second panel that was out at kind of shoulder width, and then they had cross beams attaching them all so that the guys would carry these big heavy pieces out and sit them on the floor, and they would stand up so that you could have, you know, 12 wolves there. and each wolf had its own stand-in.
We actually have a shot from Tibbet on the website of 12 guys running in with 12 cardboard cutout wolves blending to the final shot. I'm going to ask you in all seriousness, and I'm not being critical, but I'm just asking you, how valuable is that to see 12 guys run in with cardboard cutouts?
It's priceless on varying levels. First of all, it's funny as hell to watch. But then, you know, for the actors, I think, you know, a lot of times we all get so immersed in our own world of visual effects that and it's such a natural thing for us to think, okay, well, there's nothing there, but we're going to put the monster there, or we're going to put a werewolf there, and you know, it makes sense to us because we think that way. But if you think about it from an actor's point of view, of, you know, like Mackenzie Foy, she's playing Renesmee, and she's like this little girl, and she's sitting on the back of a wolf that doesn't exist, looking at another wolf that doesn't exist, and she's got to be able to emote. And no matter how brilliant the director is, you've still got to be able to rely on the actors to be able to, you know, make that final leap. And the only way that you can really do that is to show them. And so if you've got something that's there as a stand-in for an eye line, or you can show them really good renderings of, you know, what it's going to look like, or a combination of the two, it makes it so much easier for the actors to then be able to perform the sequence believably when those stand-ins are not in the sequence. Because, you know, obviously we didn't shoot them with the guys running through with the wolves. I mean, they were including everybody. So, you know, they rehearse it with them in there, and then the guys take them out and the actors do their thing on an empty stage. But yeah, it's essential. I did a film a couple of years ago with Nicolas Cage, Season of the Witch, and we had a big sequence at the end where he had to fight a demon. And, you know, it was very helpful for him to be able to see some renderings that actually Tippett did for us, and they did the demon. And when he could see what the height of the thing was relative to his height in a little scale graphic, it was like, oh, okay, so if I put my hand out there, it's going to, like, touch the chest, or it's going to be, you know, it was just a very good thing for him to see, because then he went in and he was a trooper. I mean, he worked his ass off on the show, and when Tippett got the plates, they, you know, made everything fit, and it worked well. I mean, I would much rather have an actor be able to have that information and at least be coming from a position of knowledge than to have them sitting there thinking, you know, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah. That was shot on 35mm, wasn't it?
Twilight. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Oh, Twilight? Oh, yes, it was.
Because that's been, you know, a big, or still, I guess, is for many people a big issue, whether or not to shoot effects work digitally or not. I would have thought that, and notwithstanding, I don't want to get into specifics of a million reasons why Twilight may have gone the way that it did, not least of which is that it's part of a series. But I would have thought that these days it's going to be a little easier to not shoot film, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing of not having a camera jam, not running out of film stock, not having to wait for the soup to, you know, turn your film around and see dailies. From the point of view of ease of production, I think, you know, the day is coming where it will probably go away. But it's still beautiful to shoot on film. As you know, the digital tools are getting better and better and better, and you look at things like Alexa and the Reds and, you know, some of the new Panasonic cameras, there's some beautiful stuff out there. But I think it's a historical thing to do. For those of us who are around long enough to have been able to shoot everything on film, there's always going to be kind of a little bittersweet feeling that, oh, we're not doing film anymore. But as the next generation comes up, they're not going to know what film was. It's just going to be digital, and then the tools change, and they will continue to change. And, you know, what we look at as state-of-the-art wonderment now, you know, give it another 15, 20 years and there'll be something else.
I mean, we've been talking about that studio set up for the wolves, but you were also on location, right? shooting film, which again is like a non-trivial exercise. I mean, you were up in the mountains.
We spent, well, they were there a lot longer than I was, but I came in for the last 2 months of the shoot in Louisiana, and then we were in Canada for 2 months. And, you know, we're shooting in the snow and in forests, pouring with rain, not stage rain, real rain, cold as hell. And, yeah, you know, it would be nice to have a camera that doesn't freeze up on you. But it'll happen occasionally with film.
Yeah, I don't think there's any perfect medium, but there is obviously, you know, a lot of considerations as to what goes into a decision. And in finishing up, what's next for you? Like, where would you like to be sort of going next? Do you have any aspirations to helm a film, or are you really looking to partner up with more high end features?
You know, both. I would love to helm a film. That would be great. I'm actually with a mate of mine right now writing a horror film script that, we'll see what happens with that. But it's going to be a very fun film to make. So we're talking about potentially producing that ourselves, which would be interesting. I just love doing big films. My dream now, and I said to somebody the other day, is I want to do a Bond film. That would be just a dream come true. So Barbara Broccoli, you're out there, give me a call. I sent her an email recently. I have not heard back from her yet, but who knows? I'd love to get involved in the new Star Wars films too, now that Disney has taken over Lucasfilm. Look, there's lots of opportunity out there. We've just got to see what happens. I think that's another thing, that the whole environment for film, is especially visual effects, is changing so much. You know, everything used to be LA based, and now it's very much based everywhere else.
Right.
So to do big films, you've got to be prepared to travel, and that's fine. It would be nice if some of the work came back here. Because it's been fairly devastating in the last few years to see what's happened to the visual effects business in the United States, with all the work going to India and China and England and Australia and Canada, and lovely for those countries to have that opportunity, but it would be nice to bring some of it back here as well.
Now, you kind of post a kind of a social media thing, and you've, over the last few months, I've just got to flag this, have posted some brilliant shots of you with people throughout your career. I don't know if we can reproduce any of those or flag them to them, but I must admit, yeah. I just want to say that it's just been delightful watching you post shots of you and other supervisors, but also just on set. It's been amazing.
Thanks, mate. I've always tried to get some kind of photograph of, you know, whatever I was doing, because you're only there for a short time, and then that opportunity is gone. So, you know, things like, you know, hanging out in the garden with Max von Sydow and with Carol Spinney, Big Bird, and, you know, I decided many years ago that, you know, we are so lucky to work in a business that gives us so much. At the end of the day, if you're not prepared to share that and help the next generation kind of move on and tell their own stories but learn from yours, there's really no point in doing it. So, you know, I try to share all of that stuff as much as possible.
Yeah, well, it's been great. And look, I also want to thank you so much for taking time to talk to us, because it's been a joy to be able to throw some light on some of those periods in LA. I just think it's so important. And also just hear firsthand the great work that you've done. I feel like such an underachiever in your presence. Thanks so much.
No. Hey, you guys are doing fantastic work, and the website's brilliant. And, you know, I mean, you really were able to change the whole face of, you know, how people learn about visual effects. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, thanks so much. And good luck with the next project. And obviously, Twilight's going gangbusters, so that's terrific. And again, thanks for taking time to talk to us. We do appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Mike. See you soon.
Thanks to Adam for spending some time with us. I enjoyed that, and I hope you did as well. And if you have ideas for other FX podcast topics, you can reach us by using the Contact Us link on the site at fxguide.com. Also, while you're on the FX Guide site, check out the FX Insider program. This is our membership program that offers insiders exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work that we do here at FX Guide to help us continue and grow. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases, as well as in classic films. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produce a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And don't forget, as I mentioned at the top of the show, our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.